Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
We'll be looking at chapter 19 this evening in 1 Samuel, but just as a quick overview, we've gone from chapter 15 with Saul being rejected as king over Israel, then David anointed, accepted by the people, even by Saul. And then David going in chapter 17 and conquering Goliath in his weakness. And then last couple of lessons, we've gone slowly through chapter 18, looking at how the relationship between Jonathan and David, and then how everyone started to fall in love with David. And this then sparked within Saul, I think, something that was already there, but this envy within Saul, which then fuels this relationship and right until the end of 1 Samuel of Saul versus David. So with Saul envying, or in chapter 18, now we come to chapter 19, and here we have Saul trying to kill David. Saul planning, or Saul prophesying, you might say, or David escaping. But we need to note the similarities between chapter 18 and chapter 19. Even when I was pulling up my notes to review them today, looking at them, I was even concerned that I was looking at the wrong set of notes, because the similarities between chapter 18 and chapter 19 are very, very similar. In chapter 18, we start with Jonathan in verses 1 to 5. And then in chapter 19, 1 to 7, we look at Jonathan. In chapter 18, we look at a wall in verses 10 to 11. And then chapter 19 in 9 to 10, we see that kind of same category of wall. In war, in chapter 18, verses 12 to 16. In chapter 19, we see it in verse 8. And then same with Michal. In chapter 18, the end of chapter 18, we spent some time there last week, and then again in chapter 19. So the similarities between chapter 18 and chapter 19 show the extent of their loyalty. The loyalty is verbalized in chapter 18 between the two parties, Jonathan and David, Michal and David. Now we see what actually happens when you test that, when you put that in the fire. How will they react in the situations? They're given their word to David, but how does that actually work in difficult situations? You know, that's it's easy to be able to say, I'll do something for you, but when we actually get down to it, are we actually going to put our loyalty where our words are? And this chapter really stands in contrast to that in the previous chapter. So saying you're loyal, I think, is easy. Carrying out that loyalty is difficult, especially when you have Saul standing in front of you. In a day and an age, it's easy to be able to say you're loyal to a cause, or even just to do that on social media, to be able to verbalize your loyalty. But when it comes down to reality, are we going to, we have different conversations. We're strong when with our words, but not necessarily with our actions. So the first thing we see in this chapter is, again, David and Jonathan. We see this in verses 1 to 7. Now, Matthew Henry has this great saying in his commentary where he says, a friend in need is a friend indeed. A friend in need is a friend indeed. And this is here, this relationship between David and Jonathan, one of the greatest biblical relationships between two men, I think, where they share this friendship, this unity between their love of God, but then also they put that into practice, and they're, as we've looked at before, they're knit together, so to say. So, verse 1 in chapter 19. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. So now his word is put on the line. He's made this loyalty in chapter 18. Now it's put to the test. Saul, his father, the king of Israel, is telling him and his servants that he should kill David. And previously his plan was to send David into the Philistines' camp to attack them. But clearly it's not working out that way. So again, Saul is trying to get this to work in his favor, to eliminate David. So what does he do? He gets his servants and Jonathan to do it. He hasn't succeeded, so he then goes to Jonathan. And the author shows this connection. Although Saul and Jonathan are united by blood, Jonathan sides with David because of their covenant with one another, that their blood tie is not as strong as their tie to God, that their love for God is stronger. So you remember in 1 Samuel 18, verse 1 to 5, Jonathan, the next in line, the heir to the throne, submits himself to David's leadership by word. He says that he will be there, make a covenant with him. And now we see this relationship put to the test, what actually happens when they're confronted with it. And six times, the author Samuel shows the relationship between Jonathan and Saul. His son, he mentions twice in verse 2. And then throughout the verses, he says, my or his father, in verses 2, verse 3, two times, and then again in verse 4. The author wants you to be able to see this relationship that Jonathan and Saul have, that Jonathan and Saul are his father. And how does this then fit when you think about the sixth commandment, right? Fifth commandment, honor your mother and father. What does Jonathan do in this situation? How does this work out? But it seems that you're pitting two commandments against each other when you look at this, right? Obey or honor your mother and father, or even obey your leaders, you might say. But you've also got this, go murder him, go kill David. These two commands, somewhat in tension, it seems. But we need to be cautious because we see Jonathan clearly understands the value of life. And he tells David the plan. The first thing he does is he goes and tells David. This loyalty to him is to be able to even just to be able to explain the situation, he says. He comes in verse 2, and Jonathan told David, Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard in the morning. Stay in a safe place and hide yourself. This is what he tells him to be able to do. So he's open and he's honest. He's fulfilling what he's done in his covenant. To be able to protect one another. And Jonathan uses his protection as Saul's son for David's advantage. He uses his position as Saul's son to protect David. And then he goes and speaks to Saul. And he will go out. He explains what his plan is at this point in verse 3. He says, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I will tell you. Again, Jonathan's very clear, very open, very accountable. This is very open about his situation. We watch the TV show sometimes, The Survivor. And on the TV show Survivor, it goes from day one or whatever, the days where people make their alliances. And their alliances are strong, they're firm, and they stand throughout the many tests and trials. And then by the time you get to about number 10 on the list, the alliances start to worry people. They start to question if they've made the right alliance. They start to question when they go and see this person who they made an alliance with, go and talk with someone else. They're cautious about what they're talking with someone else. They're on guard. Where Jonathan has been very, very open and honest with David. He's explaining exactly what's happening. He's not hiding anything from David. He sees this relationship as one where he needs to be open and honest. So, and Jonathan carries out what we would say is the correct approach to church discipline laid out in Matthew chapter 18. He sees his father's sin. And then what does he do? He goes and tells David and warns him of his life. But then he also goes and approaches his father, Saul. So in verse 4, he goes and speaks to Saul. So verse 4 and 5, and Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he struck down the Philistine. And the Lord worked great salvation for all of Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then do you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? So he speaks to David, and then he goes directly to his father and tells him exactly what he should do biblically speaking. You know, let not the king sin against the servant David. David hasn't sinned against you. Why is your response to go kill him? Why is your response sin? We've looked at this last week with the envy growing within him. Saul's solution is only to jump to sin, only to jump to how he would be able to handle it. He hasn't sinned against you at all. He hasn't wronged you. Actually, it's not even that he has sinned against you. He's actually done good to you. So it's not even that he's just neutral to you. Just at the end of verse 4, and because his deeds have brought good to you. Why would you want to go harm someone, not only who hasn't sinned against you, as we looked at before, that Lamech's phrase is that I'll inflict pain on you if you even just hurt me a little bit, whereas Saul's is I'll kill you for helping me. And this is exactly Jonathan's problem with him. And he explains what David has done. He's gone into sacrificially. He took his own life in his own hands and he struck down the Philistine. You know, and the Lord worked great salvation for Israel. What is your issue? What is your error with this? And you even saw it and you rejoiced in it. You celebrated with him. So why will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? He comes at it very simply and asks him a very direct question. He's done nothing wrong with you. He's actually done good for you. Why would you sin against innocent blood? David has obeyed Saul. He's done no harm to him. Actually, you'd say he's done more. He's done better. Like I said, you see the line of Saul following Cain and Lamech. Saul not only kill a man for wounding him, but he'll kill a man for helping him. However, you want to bring it up again that Jonathan here is a man of God. He's looking at this very, very biblically, isn't he? He's looking at this very biblically as he looked at this dilemma which is before him. The women praised David for killing Goliath, but they left out God. Whereas Jonathan sees the Lord as the one who used David to be able to deliver him. He says that the Lord worked a great salvation for all of Israel. He mentions David, his life, his hand. He struck down the Philistine, David, but he then connects it back to the Lord. You see his godly outlook at things. Not only is he handling the things biblically, but he gives God the glory and honor where God is due. That God has worked great salvation in Israel. That the Lord did it through David's hand. Now, I've noted the similarities previously between 18 and 19. Yet this really brings a lot of previous actions and previous chapters all together. It all shows the sinful mess and the foolishness of Saul to his shame. That God comes forward, and the promise that he gave to Abram in chapter 12 is that I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonor you I will curse, and all the families on earth shall be blessed. In this situation, God is blessing David as a seed of promise, and he's cursing Saul through his actions. And again, the similarities we see between David and Jonathan in chapter 14, as you remember, that Jonathan did a great work of the Lord against the garrison of the Philistines, and the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. That's exactly what people said when they wanted to come and take Jonathan's life in chapter 14. That Saul made this foolish oath and we must put Jonathan to death. And what did the people cry out to him? That he again was innocent and the Lord worked a great salvation in him. In chapter 14, verse 45, and the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die, who has worked a great salvation in Israel? Far from it, as the Lord lives. There shall not be one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. And Jonathan listened to the voice, Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. In verse 6, Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. So here we see him taking the Lord's name and saying that as the Lord lives, as long as God is living, then he shall not be put to death. Now this just goes to show, in a couple of chapters, how many times Saul seeks to be able to destroy David. Previously, he's blamed others and he listened to the people and not God's voice. As you remember in chapter 15, this was the major thing, the issue that happened with Saul. Saul was listening to the people, listening to whatever his heart's desires, to be honest, rather than listening to the voice of God. And here, he seems to have listened to Jonathan. But he listened and he made an oath like he has just done before. He made this oath in chapter 14, in verse 39, when he says, "For as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, though it be my Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die." So his oath then was that I will put my own son to death because I made this foolish oath. He doesn't fulfill that. Gratefully, Lord save Jonathan. But in this situation, he says that as the Lord lives, I will not put David to death. Now we'll see a change in that. But he swears on the Lord. Swearing a good oath is not good if you do not intend to keep your word. If you swear by the Lord, you're planning that you are going to fulfill that oath. Jonathan then goes and informs David of Saul's oath, and Saul seems to have this great breakthrough. He's repented finally. He's turned. His envy is put aside. He's able to eat at the same table as David. He's been able to rejoice with them. From verse 1, he goes from wanting to kill David to verse 6, he says he shall not be put to death. Jonathan here is a good friend. He acts as the role of an intercessor for David on his behalf, a mediator between his father and David. And some people try and make a comment and a connection that Jonathan is a type of Christ here. He goes and speaks to the father on David's behalf. But I think I've mentioned before that you might be able to make these connections to Christ-likeness, that here Jonathan is acting as a believer should, going to seek repentance and address someone's sin. But that does not mean he's a shadow or a type of Christ. I think those specific things are limited in how we use them. A mediator or an intercession is not used in these verses, and there's no New Testament connection to Jonathan and Christ. So we can make a connection that Jonathan is acting Christ-like, but he's not necessarily a shadow or a type. So Jonathan has now been able to go save David, been able to talk with his father, and it went back to his presence before in verse 7. And then, now we come to a wall and a war again, as we've seen it before. And there is a war again in verse 8, it says, "And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow. So they had fled, that they fled before him." Now we've seen this before. David is successful in going into war. He's a valiant army full of men leaving and coming back into the city, rejoicing the people seeing this, coming out and coming back with their plunder, their defeat. And there are men and soldiers and things coming that have taken from their enemy, coming back in. And I'm sure the women and the children running back and celebrating yet another victory for David. And maybe even singing again that Saul has killed 1,000, but David his tens of thousands. However, the author really tries to show the extent to which Saul treats and hates David. As we've noted before, the end of chapter 18 in verse 29, "And Saul was even more afraid of David, so Saul was David's enemy continually." The start of chapter 19, he wants him dead. Chapter 6, he shall not be put to death. Yet what does he do in the next few verses? "David struck down the enemy so that they fled. Now Saul struck down his enemy so that he fled." In verses 9 to 10. "Then a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul. So that he struck the spear into the wall, David fled and escaped that night. That he uses this same word to pin in Hebrew, as just as David has struck the Philistines, now, hakat, now just as David has struck his enemy, Saul is striking his enemy again. This word that he, this vow, this oath that he made, that surely the Lord, as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death within a few moments. David's accepted his repentance. He's gone back. He's gone into his presence as before. But just as it happened in chapter 18, the same thing is happening in chapter 19. Saul is not going to keep his oath. He's willing to murder his son to look good in front of others, upholding his oath. Yet behind closed doors, even if it is in public, he would rather murder David than keep his oath. Now, we haven't spoken much about when this word comes up of harmful spirit. We've seen it a couple of times before. 16 verse 14, 15, 16, 23, 18 verse 10, and then 19 verse 10. And so it's translated in the ESV as harmful spirit. In the New American Standard Bible, in the King James Version, it's an evil spirit. In the New King James, it's distressing spirit. And even in the Young's literal translation, an earlier translation, it's a sadness is the word that it uses there. In verses in 16 and 13, you remember that as David was anointed as king in verse 13 by Samuel, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. And then in verse 14, and the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him. So we have literally in verse 13, the Spirit of Yahweh was on David from that day. And then in the very next verse, we see the Spirit of the Lord leaving Saul, and then the spirit of harmful spirit from the Lord torment him. So literally, the Spirit of Yahweh or the spirit of evil connected it together like the Spirit of Yahweh versus from Yahweh. So in verse 13 in chapter 16, it's the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David. In verse 14, it's the harmful spirit from the Lord. So there's a difference between the Spirit of the Lord been upon someone and the harmful spirit from the Lord. They're not the same spirit. It's not like he has a good side and a bad side and it just rushes, the good side leaves and then the bad side stays. We see the Lord here, sovereign over all things, yet we still see that Satan is rushing upon Saul. In Job 1, there's a council of all the people, and the Lord is there, and Satan comes to, and the Lord tells Satan in verse 12 in Job 1:12, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So David, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And again in Job verse 2, verse 6, and the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life." Here we have the Lord directing Satan how to address Job and what he is permitted to do. He is only allowed to take away things from Job, as it says in verse 1. "All that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." Satan is then, you might say, sent by God. But it's not God then is the means in which Job is inflicted with this pain. It is Satan who is causing that. You can call these secondary causes, whatever you want to call. So here, the Lord sends the harmful spirit upon Saul, but it's not necessarily the Lord. It is not the Lord who is the harmful spirit. He is sending a harmful spirit from the Lord. So we see this clear connection of evil and this evil spirit and these sinful actions. We need to see the importance that God is the one who is doing it through secondary means. God is still sovereign all over this, but he's not then the author of sin. So Saul also can't then just say it's his own fault. God made me do it. Or even Satan made me do it. That's not what we say. It is sin truly that is causing these actions. As the Lord says to Cain that sin is crouching at your door and all you need to do is rule over it. That it's still the sin of Saul, which is coming to this. So now we come back to the broken promise of Saul. Saul has now tried to pin David to the wall three times. So David rightly doesn't hang around at this moment. He flees. Wise man, you know, third time's a charm, right? So he runs. And where does he run? He runs to his own home. He runs to his wife, Michal, in verses 11 to 17. So he escapes that night. Now we've seen Jonathan, Saul's son, how he deals with this situation. Jonathan, his son, has stood up to his father. He has followed through with his loyal promise, his covenant to David. So how does it react now when Saul's other child, his daughter, Michal? Now, the author spends a lot of time in the first verses pointing out the relationship between Jonathan and Saul, his son. He points that out a lot. Whereas in this time, he doesn't necessarily make that connection. The Michal is not necessarily Saul's. We know he's Saul's daughter, but he doesn't make that connection, that emphasis, as he does with Jonathan. Now, he does mention that he's David's wife, but he doesn't even point that out a lot as he does. He almost goes out of his way to point out that Jonathan is Saul's son, but he doesn't go out of his way to do this. So what does Saul do in this situation? David has fled, David has escaped, and Saul sends messages, verse 11, to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, "If you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So you need to leave before Saul takes your life. Here's your two options. You can stay here tonight or you die in the morning. So here, we need to pause a little bit and address something that we'll be doing throughout the rest of the time as we go through 1 Samuel. An interesting point we need to make here that is that of David as the psalmist. Now, David is attributed in the titles of the Psalms to at least 73 Psalms. And 75, if you connect what they say in the New Testament to the references they attribute to him in the Old Testament. So over half, at least half, are attributed to David. But you could attribute it even more to David himself. So more could have been written by him. And we're not told of every single occasion that we find in the Psalms about the historical event which they're tied to. But we are given times when David's life, when he actually penned a psalm. So the psalm, we know that the Psalms are written within history, but we don't know necessarily the time in history they're written. But we do have, God has given us some of those times. Now, some of those might be that the Psalms are written not just for David and not just for historical prayers that David prayed for us to look at, although they are, but they're also written for us. And a lot of the Psalms don't necessarily go into detail about who the enemy is or what the situation he finds himself in. But we are given some times and situations where the title of the psalm actually tells us about the historical event in which they're tied to. So, this is actually the first time that we know of that a psalm was written within a historical event. The first time that during David's life that a psalm was written. And that's actually in Psalm 59. And it says, "To the choir master, according to the Do Not Destroy, a Maktim of David, when Saul sent men to watch his house in order to kill him." And during this time, at least five psalms are written during this time that we would mention the fleeing of Saul, directly tied to Saul and fleeing. Now, we're going to, as we go through, next week, we're actually not going to look at Psalm 20, 1 Samuel 20, we're going to actually look at Psalm 59 during this historical event, because that really helps us understand that psalm a little bit more. And also, I think it shows how a different side of what we get to see in this historical narrative. We get to see a little bit of David's mind. David didn't write 1 Samuel. Samuel wrote up to this, you know, up to his death in 1 Samuel. So we get to see a different perspective, and I think that'll be helpful for us to do it. Now, some of it, we might not be able to know exactly when they're happening. Psalm 142 is said that it's a prayer written in a cave, but there's two different instances where he's fleeing from someone and in a cave. He flees from Saul, and he also flees from his son Absalom. So throughout this study, we'll take these breaks when we see, when we come up to them and look at these psalms that are attributed with the titles. So next week, we'll look at Psalm 59, and then we'll take some time to know the situation because we know where we are when we look at this, and it helps us. So David then comes and he flees out the window, just like Rahab did in Joshua 2. So he and his wife is there, and his wife takes it on herself to set up like a Ferris Bueller type plan or a Home Alone type thing. He takes an image, which is a household idol or a household god. Now, might again just pause and reflect on this situation here. Michal is there, and in their house, it's not that they go down to the other house to borrow it. In their house, they have this household idol. And why do they have a household god? Again, if you bring up Judges 17 and again 18, it's not a good chapter to think about. We don't have time necessarily to go into this situation, but I think just put that in your back of your mind when you think about Michal. You know, Jonathan is clear. He loves the Lord. He, you know, you see this and the relationship between David and Jonathan. The Lord is central in that. Whereas Michal, it's hard necessarily to understand where she's at. But again, this is one of these things just take note of. So she gets this idol, puts it in the bed, and she sets up this with goat's hair and these clothes. And she tells them that he is sick. So as from, again, you remember verse 6, Saul's oath. What did he say to his son? As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. And then in verse 15, what does Saul say? And Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, bring him to me in bed, that I may kill him. Again, it doesn't take long. You know, maybe a matter of 24 hours, even less, I would say, before him making this oath. And the messengers go in and they find out about what Michal has done. But Michal confronts her father again, tells David of the plan, and now she confronts her father, just as Jonathan confronts his father. So Saul said to Michal, why did you deceive me thus and let my enemy go so that he has escaped? Michal answered Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? So now we see two times that Michal has lied. She is sick in bed and then also attributing false words to David. Now it's great ethical question I think you could ask about, you know, whether it's right if you're in World War II and you've got Nazis knocking on your door and you have Jews hiding underneath your floorboards. But again, we don't have time to go through that ethical question. What level is Michal's words lying to her? It's hard to be able to say, and then also to maybe potentially give her grace. She has her father standing in front of her, who's known to be an angry man. She's probably there by herself. Maybe the threat of physical violence has gone over. She's fearful. We'll actually see that David actually lies in a couple of chapters ahead. Again, good ethical questions to look at, but we don't have time to do so tonight. So Jonathan stands firm. And Michal is good to David most of the time. Jonathan is more godly and I think more committed to David than Michal. But also, I think again, Michal here is a woman in this period of time, an extremely tall father, quite mentally unstable. I don't think, again, to justify sin, but I think we need to understand that not all sins are equally heinous. When we come to situations like this, we need to understand that. So now what does Samuel do? Jonathan has saved him. Michal has saved him. So David runs to Samuel. Now, he's met him once that he knows of, that we know of in verse 16. He anoints him, and then Samuel's kind of out of the picture. So he writes about him, Psalm 99, most likely penned by David. Moses and Aaron were among the priests. Samuel also was among those who called upon his name. They called upon the Lord, and he answered them. And in Jeremiah 15:1, and the Lord said to me, just speaking to Jeremiah, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my heart would not turn towards this people. Send them out of my sight and let them go. So we've not heard of him since chapter 16, verse 13. He anoints David and then abruptly just goes back to Ramah. So we've seen godly people, and what does he do? He goes and seeks godly people. He seeks out godly people when persecuted. David does not choose strength. We know in beginning of chapter 8 that Samuel is old. He's old in chapter 8. He's most likely a lot older now. We don't know the time differences between chapter 8 and chapter 19. But we know that Saul was king for about 40 years. So maybe 20 years has passed. So what's old plus 20? You know, he doesn't go to someone who's going to be able to keep him strong physically. He goes to a godly man, Samuel. So Samuel starts with Eli. When he's 11, Jewish historian says, and then chapter 8, he's older. So all on foot, there's no dialogue here. Saul finds out, he sends his messengers to find David, and three times they're sent out. The Spirit of God upon messengers, and they prophesy three times. We see this happening. And in verse 20, we see a company of prophets there, and they're prophesying, and Samuel standing over them. And then Saul goes, sends out some people, and they come back, and they're prophesying. And eventually, Saul just takes things into his own hands. He's had enough. So he goes himself. Saul goes to Ramah himself and comes to greet at the great well of Sikhu. And he asked, "Where is Samuel and David?" And one said, "Behold, they are at Naroth in Ramah." So he told them exactly where they are, but that's what they told before, right? In verse 19, they told them exactly where David was. And what does Saul do? He gets lost again. Remember that first time where we met Saul? He goes looking for his donkeys, and he can't find his donkeys, and he's trying to find this thing, and eventually he runs into he's not a good person to go and find things. You know, he has to ask again. He goes to the well, and they said, "Where is he?" Well, we told you in verse 19. So he goes there looking for Ramah, and he misses it by a long shot. You know, I did have a map that was meant to go up here that would explain the distances, but he doesn't even know his own kingdom. Just another note there. So eventually in verse 23, he goes to Ramah, and the Spirit of God comes upon him, and he prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramah. So this word here, prophesied, is the same word which is raved in verse 18, verse 11, when he's there and a harmful spirit rushed upon Saul and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre. And he did day by day. So here this harmful spirit happens and the Spirit of God rushes upon him. We've noted that several times, the Spirit of Yahweh and then the Spirit of God. Not making too much light of it, there is some times when Samuel refers to the Spirit of Yahweh upon Saul. But I think that there's this distinction between Yahweh, the covenant-keeping personal God, upon David, and then the Spirit of God upon Saul. God is the creator. So he finally prophesies with them, just like the other messengers had. He finally gets there and he follows the previous fate of the previous messages. And he stripped off all of his clothes. He stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? So this word here, stripped, is the same word which is used in Jonathan in chapter 18. And like we've mentioned before, this word can mean to be naked. It doesn't necessarily mean to be naked. But what I made then was that when Jonathan stripped, there was no reference to the word naked. Whereas in this verse, it says that he stripped and he laid naked. There's that connection. So there's two options here. Is that he stripped his royal robe and laid naked means that he was lightly dressed. Maybe, you know, you might use it when someone's changing their clothes, or, you know, when you're changing a child's diaper, they've still got their diaper on and you say that they're naked. That might be the term. Or that it actually means he stripped his royal robes and he was actually what we would infer and call naked. So normally naked does mean naked, but not always. In Genesis 2:24, therefore a man should leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. However, nakedness is really connected to shame. So Saul is shamed. The high and powerful king, the mighty one of, you know, Israel, you might call him, the most powerful man with the things at his disposal. And here he is in a babbling mess on the ground like a baby, naked. And so Saul is asked, people ask, if Saul among the prophets. Now remember back to chapter 10 when Saul was anointed by the Lord and he went, and the same question was asked when he met with these prophets and he started prophesying with them as well. Is Saul also among the prophets? So, we see this connection. And Saul has tried to be a king. He's tried to be a priest, and he's also now tried to be a prophet. So, not sure what it means to prophesy, but I think in this sense, it paints a negative picture of what Saul is doing. It's not necessarily that he's turned into a godly man, but I think what it gives me the understanding that he is helpless in this situation. You know, is he a good prophet or is he just a prophet? So there is another issue that comes up in this text that, again, people bring up. Is at the end of chapter 15, when Saul is rejected as king, Saul is there. Samuel walks away and Saul tries to grab his corner of his robe. And at the end of chapter 15, it says that Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. But Samuel grieved over Saul. So, but now, in this chapter, he's prophesying before Samuel in verse 24. And he stripped off his clothes and he too prophesied before Samuel. And he laid naked. So, I think both of these can be true at the same time. Now, I think both of these can be true. You have a group of men before you. And then Samuel is overseeing them. Samuel could be a large distance off, but you might not be able to see the one man in a crowd. I think this is to show, the purpose of this is to show the further demise of Saul. But ultimately, during this time, David is able to flee. In verse 1 of chapter 20, and David fled from Naioth in Ramah, and he came before Jonathan. What have I done? What is my guilt? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? So here, David in this chapter is saved by Jonathan and Michal and Samuel. But most importantly, the Lord. It's the Lord who is protecting his anointed king. Why do the nations rage? The author of Psalm 2 writes, why do the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. This is the situation we find ourselves in. The king of Israel, although David is anointed as king, the king of Israel who sits on the throne, sets himself against David, against the Lord's anointed. It seems that David has no hope. He's been pursued strongly by David, by his whole army at his disposal. Yet the Lord has given him Jonathan, Michal, and even Samuel. Psalm 2 doesn't just end there with the king setting themselves against the Lord anointed. Verses 4 and 6, who is he who sits in heaven laughs? The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. Saul is just a mere man who is like the stream in the stream of water in the hands of God. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of God, the author of Proverbs writes in 21:1. In the beginning of the next section, we really see David truly lives out this period of being a fugitive. Saul becomes like a hungry dog on the prowl. Can you remember the novel Moby Dick? This enormous novel, this long novel, is really just fueled by this one person's envy, this one person's idea to be able to capture and chase down this enormous white whale called Moby Dick. And Captain Ahab will stop at nothing to be able to capture Moby Dick. It consumes him. He doesn't care how many people of his crew he loses, how many ships are lost at sea. In the end, it is envy that destroys Captain Ahab. In the end, it's envy that drives him to his death. I think that's the thing that kills him. And this is what happens to Saul. He's just so consumed by David. Although Saul takes a predominant role in a lot of these chapters, it's David that still consumes Saul's mind. It's David that still is the one that is underlying all this. And Saul here is the same as Captain Ahab, and David is like Moby Dick. And the Lord is protecting his anointed king, not Saul, but David. The Lord blessed David, not only with the faith to be able to carry out his calling, but also the support to be able to do this as well. In this situation, David has nothing but other people by his side to be able to help him. And the Lord has blessed him with these people to be able to get him through this situation. It's David who has him, his friends by his side. It's Jonathan that warns him. It's Michal that saves him. It's Samuel that distracts Saul to be able to leave. The Lord is the one who is doing this through other people. Psalm 59 verse 16 and 17, but I will sing of your strength, he writes. I will sing aloud of your steadfast love in the morning, for you have been my fortress and a refuge in the day of my distress. O my strength, I will sing praises to you, for you, O God, are my fortress, the God who shows me steadfast love. He has this great enemy, but he has an even greater God that sees him through all of this.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.